Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Educational Support Services, Understanding IEPs and 504 Plans for Students Diagnosed with TM, including AFM, ADEM, and NMOSD. I'm Roberta Pesce from the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. We are very pleased to be joined by Sam Huge of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, TM, and NMOSD program, who will be moderating our podcast for today. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis, or you can also send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar.
Thanks, Roberta. The 2015 TMA Ask the Expert podcast series is made possible in part through the generous support of Chugai Pharmaceutical Company and Alexion Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Chugai Pharmaceuticals is conducting clinical studies to create original and innovative drugs, both in the United States and overseas, to address unmet medical needs and neurological disorders where the level of pharmaceutical contribution and satisfaction concerning patient treatment remains low. Alexion Pharmaceuticals is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist is driven by the knowledge that people's lives depend on their work. For today's podcast, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Lana Harder and Dr. Anjali Forber-Pratt. Dr. Lana Harder has served since 2008 as a clinical neuropsychologist at Children's Medical Center, Dallas, and is currently Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Associate Professor of Neurology and Neurotherapeutics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She's board certified in clinical neuropsychology and specializes in the neuropsychological evaluation of pediatric patients from infancy to young adults with disorders of the central nervous system. Dr. Harder's research interests include cognitive and psychosocial outcomes for pediatric neuroimmunologic disorders. Dr. Anjali Forber-Pratt is an assistant professor at the Department of Human and Organizational Development at Vanderbilt University. Her research agenda adopts a social ecological framework and looks at issues surrounding identity, equity, and empowerment through the methodology for individuals who are different in some way, with a large focus on disability. Outside of the academy, Dr. Forber-Pratt was also a member of Team USA at the 2008 and 2012 Paralympic Games. So I wanted to start out, Dr. Harder and Dr. Forber-Pratt, if you could introduce your experience in IEPs and 504 plans and give an overview of the main differences between the two before we jump into the questions. So Dr. Harder, would you like to begin?
Sure. Thank you, Sam, and thanks to the TMA for having me for this important podcast. A big part of my job is working with schools to ensure that the patients I work with have what they need when they leave their homes to go and get their education. And so my experience, as Sam said, goes back to 2008 when I came to Children's, and even prior, working in educational and clinical settings where I evaluate kids who have some sort of central nervous system condition that may affect daily functioning. So my job as I evaluate kids is to describe how these individuals learn, how their medical condition may impact that at school, and most importantly, I describe opportunities for intervention, say in a classroom setting or in other daily activities. So I have the privilege of working with schools on just about a weekly basis in my work here with Dr. Greenberg's clinic with pediatric demyelinating conditions. So I'm routinely speaking to schools. I attend school meetings, sometimes by phone, sometimes in person, to help describe the needs and also put these into a plan for our students and our kids. So that's the background that I have, and I'll let Anjali speak to some of the differences between the plans.
Sounds good. So first of all, a little bit of background of my experience working with these plans. I was actually diagnosed with transverse myelitis when I was 4.5 months old. And so personally, I was assessed by my school district for early intervention services, and at the time was put on an IEP plan myself. And during my time in middle school, when we really truly identified that most of my needs were purely around the physical access and accommodations in that regard, I transitioned to a 504 plan. So the rest of my schooling, I had a 504 plan myself. When I got to high school, however, I encountered quite a significant amount of barriers in terms of compliance with my 504 plan and being able to actually receive the accommodations that I needed in order to succeed in high school. So I was actually involved in a federal lawsuit against my school district that fell under the Americans with Disabilities Act based on not really being able to abide by my 504 plan in order for me to get an education. Moving on beyond that, I have also worked as a speech-language pathologist in schools where I was involved, much like Dr. Harder was saying, involved in IEP meetings and so forth, but I was also involved with actually helping to write specific goals for children based on their needs and so forth. In my current role right now, I'm actually a professor and I'm working with future school counselors, so I'm also helping those school counselors to make sure that they're aware of the differences and so forth between these two plans and making sure that they're able to be a strong resource for their students, which kind of brings me to the next point of kind of highlighting the high-level differences between an IEP and a 504 plan. An IEP is a blueprint or plan for a child's special education experience at school, whereas a 504 plan is a blueprint or plan for how a child will have access to learning at school. So the main level differences there are that an IEP really is more concerned with academic need as well as curricular modifications, whereas a 504 plan has to do more with physical accommodations and other types of accommodations that can lead to greater student success, but does not have anything to do with curricular modifications. These two plans also, as I kind of alluded to in the beginning, are covered by two different laws. So an IEP plan is covered by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, and that is the federal law that provides protections and outlines the guidelines for how this whole process works, whereas a 504 plan is covered by the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, also federal law, so federal civil rights law, but has more to do with with preventing discrimination against people with disabilities. In order to get an IEP, there are two requirements that a child has one or more of the 14 specific disabilities listed in IDEA. And secondly, that the disability must affect a child's educational performance and or ability to learn and benefit from the general education curriculum. In order to get or be eligible for a 504 plan, there are two requirements: that a child has any disability, which and also that disability interferes with a child's ability to learn in a general education classroom, and that accommodations are needed. Those are kind of the main, I guess I would say, highlights of the two differences between the two plans. Dr. Harder, did you want to add anything to that?
I thought that was a fabulous overview. The one thing I would add, and I should have stated regarding my background, is that I've worked in higher education settings. So working in the Services for Students with Disabilities office, where my role was to review documentation for our students with cognitive disabilities and then help students determine the most appropriate accommodation. So this section 504, as we talk about 504 plans, and as Anjali noted, this doesn't have anything to do with modifying the curriculum, but giving that extra support, accommodations like extra time would be a great example. So through the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, we're able to extend those type of 504 accommodations to higher education settings. So questions that come up a lot for the patients that I work with here at Children's are, will I be able to get these services when it's time to go to college? And the answer is yes, and we can get into that in more detail, but I did just want to kind of mention that as we're talking about the federal law that sort of guides what we do for students across different academic settings.
Yeah, that's a huge clarification, I think, at least from my part, from my perspective about the differences between the plans. And there are a lot of questions that came in from the community about kind of more specific nuances with how to function within these plans or how to get them. And so I'm going to get through as many as we can, but I apologize in advance to all of our listeners if I don't get to your question. There's a lot here, so I'm going to hopefully get to the spirit of some of these questions. To kind of further flesh out the overview that you guys gave, there are some, I guess, more specific questions. Does anyone ever need or have both a 504 and IEP in place at the same time? Dr. Harder, would you like to speak to that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In my experience, I would say no to that, that usually the student who qualifies for special education or the IEP they'll be served, let me put it this way. If they qualify for an IEP, they would sort of also qualify for 504 in a way. So in a sense, IEP would trump the 504, and so a student that needs an IEP would be served under an IEP only. And Anjali, please correct me if you've seen this done differently. And then a 504, those who qualify for 504 may not qualify for an IEP, and so they are given accommodations through the 504 plan.
Yes, and from my experience, that's spot on. In my own experience as a younger child, like I mentioned in my intro, I did have an IEP, but when we really got into it and discovered that the specific accommodations that I was needing and support really fell under the purview of a 504, the decision was made to make that switch. So it was an either or in my own situation. And same is true for the students that I worked with. So if there is any type of an academic need, then you would fall under an IEP, but you would still be eligible for those physical classroom requirements and so forth, but you would only have an IEP plan.
Mm-hmm. And as Anjali highlights, that you know, students could definitely move between those. And I've had situations where we felt like we would start with a 504, and if that was not meeting the needs of the student, we could then take it up to a more comprehensive plan under an IEP. There have also been cases where we decided an IEP was maybe, you know, not necessary, and we stepped down to a 504. So I think that's an important point, that if you set up one of these plans, this is not in stone for the long term.
Correct. Moving on to what you were saying earlier on with accommodations in a college setting, there's a question about, do 504s and IEPs apply in college? And as you said, they certainly do and can. But what if the child did not have any kind of special accommodation in high school or before that, but now they think one is necessary for college? Is there going to be a requirement that they had accommodations as a high school student, or can they start the process in college?
Yeah, great question. So you do not necessarily have to have a history of having accommodations, say, in high school in order to access those in college. Where that may come up is when students try to get accommodations for things like the SAT or ACT. In my experience, those groups that sort of oversee those exams and approve accommodations, they want to see that there's been a history that not only the person has qualified for accommodations but has used those in high school. But when it comes to college and accessing accommodations, the things that are important are that there is a documentation to support that, either, you know, from a physician, from a, depending on what the accommodations are that are being requested. So a neuropsychologist like myself, I can provide a comprehensive report with recommendations, and those would often include things that would be that a student could access at college. And I gave the example of extra time, maybe note-taking assistance, preferential seating. Those are examples, but the student would need to have documentation of the disability and, most importantly, the functional impact of the disability. So in other words, how does a disability affect them in daily life and in a classroom setting? And with that case laid out in a report or a letter from a doctor, oftentimes, you know, they're able to access those accommodations.
And I just want to add kind of as a clarification point, so the IDEA, which governs IEPs, does not apply to the post-secondary setting. However, an IEP can inform those types of accommodations that Dr. Harder is talking about. Whereas a Section 504 and a 504 plan, it is inclusive of elementary, secondary, and post-secondary students. So I just want to make sure that is a little bit clearer for folks.
I think that's a great clarifying point. And I would also say that one thing to remember about accessing services in college is that when a student applies to college, their disability status is not, it's not disclosed, it's not a part of the application process. The student must be otherwise qualified to be in college. At the end of college, when a student receives a diploma, that diploma will be equivalent to the student who did not have accommodations or who did not have a disability. So it's, I think, important to make the point, as we've highlighted already, that there is no modification to the curriculum. So our students in college have to do essentially the same things as their sort of non-disabled counterparts, but possibly with, you know, these things like extended time.
Dr. Harder, you mentioned a little bit earlier, or you touched on the process of having documentation proof of disability and any functional deficit that might exist. There was some question here about basically how you begin the process of getting a 504 IEP plan. And does it require specifically a physician's request or another type of medical professional? And how do you really begin the process of working with the schools and your healthcare team to make these accommodations occur?
So I would say there are many avenues to accessing support in educational settings, just as a general statement. You know, we recommend to families that you know, as they approach a school to request services, to request an evaluation, to determine if services are appropriate, that we have them put everything in writing. In some places, some states, which can vary, that starts a clock. So there are so many days a school has to respond to get the ball rolling with that. In our setting, very often the process starts when our patients come to clinic and they are evaluated by me, by the medical team, and we identify things that the student would need in an educational setting. So we generate our reports and our letters and things like that. It's important to note that just because I, Dr. Harder, or our physicians make these recommendations, the school is who decides if the student qualifies as a student with a disability and for what types of services. So I always think that's important to remember, but it is really valuable, in my opinion, to enlist the support of the medical team as you pursue this type of support. So for certain qualifying categories, so other health impairment is a category, under special education where a student can qualify for services, and in those cases we do have to have a physician sign off on what the medical condition is and how it affects the child. So similarly for 504 plans, if the disability is medical in nature, we need physicians to sign off on that. So approaching the school is very important, working with the team to get the appropriate documentation. I think each of those things are really important to kind of get things going in pursuing these services.
Yeah, and I just want to add a few other things to that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, first of all, it's okay if you disagree with, because Dr. Harder was mentioning that it's up to the school to then decide if services are warranted and so forth. There may be a situation where you disagree with what the school district comes back with. And depending on if you're being considered for an IEP versus a 504 plan, that dispute process looks a little bit different. But basically, in kind of the high level overview, is that there are set requirements that allow for mediation, that allow for dispute resolution, filing official complaints, and potentially having a hearing. Again, that one depends which category you're being considered with, and then potentially a state complaint before it gets to a complaint at the federal level. But I think that's important for parents and teenagers and individuals to understand that it is possible that you may not agree with either what the school district is coming back with in terms of the types of accommodations or in terms of potentially the types of least restrictive environment and the setting in which you are looking to get an education in. The other part that I also would like to add to this too is what this means in terms of a higher education setting. So under Section 504, as we've been talking about, the school districts are required to provide a free appropriate public education, or FAPE, and that's the term that you may have heard, to each student with a disability in the district's jurisdiction. And unlike in high school, your post-secondary school is not required to provide a free and appropriate public education. Rather, the post-secondary school is required to provide appropriate academic adjustments and accommodations to ensure that discrimination on the basis of disability does not occur. So when we're talking about documentation and so forth, certainly if you have been receiving accommodations prior to entering college, like Dr. Harder mentioned, that may be one source of documentation, but it's not always the only documentation that is required. In the instance where, like one of the questions that came in, that say, hypothetically, I was not receiving any accommodations throughout my time in middle school, high school, and so forth, and I get to college and I would like to be considered for different accommodations, that is definitely something that is within your rights to do. But then the question comes up, who pays for that new evaluation? Neither your high school or your post-secondary school is required to conduct or pay for a new evaluation to document a disability or need for accommodations. So therefore, that cost may fall on you in order to find that appropriate professional and so forth. That said, I tend to encourage individuals, if they think that they may have a diagnosable disability and so forth, try if you can to get it diagnosed and get the documentation of the types of accommodations while you're still in high school, if possible, is one of the recommendations I would say.
That's good. That's good to know and good to understand. There's a question in here. Since the 504 and IEP plans are fall under federal law, there's a question about, do private or charter schools have to follow the same kind of guidelines for establishing these support services as public schools do, or is there a difference between what's required of the different types of school settings? Anjali, do you think?
Sure, yeah. So I'll jump in and start off on this question. So the short answer is it depends. So basically, if a private school receives any type of federal dollars, which many do, then they are mandated to comply with Section 504. However, when we're talking about IDEA and IEPs and so forth, that law and that statute does not apply to private schools. Private schools are not covered under IDEA, the special education law. However, if a public school places a child with an IEP in a private school as part of the IEP, then it's the public school that remains responsible for ensuring that the private school implements the IEP. And so, like I said, this is where it gets a little bit confusing. And again, like I mentioned just a little bit ago, children who attend public schools are entitled to a free, appropriate education and an IEP, and they receive funding from the federal government. Private schools do not receive this funding and therefore are not required to provide a free, appropriate education. And so they are not required to provide special education services to children with disabilities. However, private schools are bound by Section 504 and need to make the physical accommodations and supports in place. So things such as, you know, providing ramps, providing access to educational opportunities, and structural modifications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, that clarifies some things, definitely. In terms of requesting evaluations from the school, for example, if you're requesting a PT evaluation or OT or what have you, does the school have to comply with the request, or does it require some outside documentation? Dr. Harder, can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's my understanding that the school will initiate a process to look into this and to determine what is needed, if anything specifically is requested, if it's an evaluation or services for learning difficulties or whatever the case may be, that there is kind of a process. And this will vary by school district, even state to state. I think there are different procedures in place. I do think it's helpful to, if you have documentation, particularly from the medical team or the medical provider that is working with your child, to bring in anything that you do have to initiate the process. But my understanding is that, school is going to make some decisions about how these evaluations will take place, which ones will be, appropriate given the situation. And I think, as Dr. Forber-Pratt mentioned earlier, there, we need to demonstrate this educational need that the disability, if they are determined to fall into a certain category, that's affecting their ability to participate in a classroom setting. I don't know if you would add to that.
Yeah, I would just add that it is going to vary state by state. So the different states have their own guidelines in terms of what that timeline looks like. So some states are very specific. And so, when you make a formal request, say, for example, for an OT evaluation or a PT evaluation, that they have X number of days to respond. And so I would encourage all individuals to get familiar with your state guidelines and so forth. And I will provide to the group and so forth a couple links that are helpful to know what is my state education website that pertains specifically to this type of legislation in terms of disability guidelines. The other part too that I would also add is to remember that the purpose of physical therapy and occupational therapy within a school setting is very different than within the clinical setting. And so sometimes that can also be kind of an important distinction to make. For example, in a school setting, physical therapists will help to ensure that students can safely access the school environment, participate in physical activities like phys ed class, recess, and things like that. And OTs are also helpful when in school settings with specializing in fine motor accommodations, adapted writing implements, and things like that. And so I think it's also important that just to kind of keep in mind that what those types of services and so forth look like in a school may be different than what you're used to in a clinical or medical setting.
Mm-hmm. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, we've kind of talked about the nuts and bolts of how IEPs and 504 plans work. But there was some question kind of about timeline and how to handle some specifics. The one in particular, if you have a young child who's starting school, who'll need a 504 IEP plan, what is the appropriate time to really start that conversation with the school before the child enters into, say, kindergarten?
Yeah, so I can jump in on that one and say it is never too early. The sooner the better. With a lot of this stuff, as you can imagine, it's a process. From my own personal experience, I shared earlier, I was diagnosed when I was 4.5 months old. I was first assessed by my school district for early intervention services when I was 2 years old. And so part of that was just start to plan ahead for my kindergarten placement and for elementary school and so forth, and making sure that all the ducks were going to be in a row and so forth. It would behoove you to make sure to start early and to do everything you can to get it all in writing. Because if you just have a conversation in passing, or even just conversation in a meeting, for example, unless it's in writing, there's not really documentation or proof that conversation actually occurred.
Dr. Harder, do you have anything?
I agree with that completely. Kind of starting sooner the better. We believe in being proactive, having things in place. And then, if over time things change or it's determined that a certain level of support is not needing, we could always back down. But very good to be kind of prepared and set the child up for success early on.
There were some specific questions that were asked by the community that I think I'll kind of boil down to what kind of accommodations can you ask for? Like, how far, I guess, could you go in asking the schools to change some things? For example, there's a question saying that the school's playground utilizes wood chips under the playground equipment, but that it's difficult for those who have a physical impairment to walk on. Is it appropriate? Does it fall under the auspices of these kinds of support services to request that the wood chips be removed and a new surface be put on, or is that too much? Is that not fall under these plans? How far can you kind of take the schools in accommodating the physical disabilities of the children?
So I can jump in and start on that one, and I would say, first of all, it depends. And it depends on the nature of a specific child's nature of their disability. It depends on the documentation to support that disability, and it depends on it, and it's going to vary school to school, district by district, state by state. I know that's a very frustrating answer, and I would also kind of add to that it is 100% within your purview to advocate for what you think is best for your child or for yourself. And from my own experience, something like that, I would have the tendency to try to build the case for inclusion on all aspects, including extracurriculars and recess and field trips and things of that nature. And in some ways, you're going to come across some districts and some district leaders where you may be met with resistance by doing so. However, like I said, I believe it is well within your right to at least advocate and to at least try and to build that case. So that would be my own personal recommendation.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%. And I think thinking about safety also is, in addition to access, we've referred to the least restrictive environment. So, making sure that our kids with disabilities are able to participate as much as possible alongside their non-disabled peers. All of those things are very important, and I agree completely that, asking for these things, advocating for these things is a very, reasonable thing to do, and that, can start a conversation and hopefully, yield some results to improve access.
Are there any special rules with those buildings, say school buildings, that were built that are grandfathered in pre-ADA requirements in terms of asking for addition of, say, handrails or something of that nature? Are there different rules for those older buildings?
There are. Unfortunately, older buildings and some historic buildings and so forth, you hear this term that, we're grandfathered in or we don't have to comply, and that's not entirely true. So while that may be the case in the essence that the building itself is not required to to be up to whatever particular building code that may be, they are still obligated to provide education in the least restrictive environment and to provide whatever accommodations are necessary. So with that, I would say it is important to still advocate and so forth, and even if you're kind of faced with some resistance with that, again, it's going to vary disability to disability, school by school, and so forth. From my own experience, I was in that exact boat. So my school was built, in the late 60s at the time, and so they were very reluctant and hesitant to meet my demands for particular ramps to be brought to code for particular kind of building modifications such as that installation of curb cuts and things like that. One thing that I would caution is that it's also difficult to have a firm grounding when it's one specific issue. So really, in my case, what was my tipping point was that we had hundreds of issues. And so then we were able to say, hey, here are all of the areas in which, that say, for example, the school is not safe for me. So for me, it was the fact that the ramps were not to code, and so the incline was too steep, and they waxed the ramps to make them look pretty, which made them very slippery. And so we were able to add that to a long list of other building type modifications in order to build that case.
Moving on to kind of shifting gears a little bit, in terms of the best process for changing what's an existing IEP or 504 plan, is there a specific process for changing either to add to accommodations or maybe take them away, depending on the circumstance? And how much really needs to be put into those plans in terms of details? How granular do they really need to be? For example, do you need to have in there that they have to stretch so many times a day, or they have to do self-cath and nurse supervision and wet backup plans and emergency plans? How detailed do these plans need to be? Does the school need to know everything about the medical needs and history of the child? And as things are added, how does the change need to occur with the IEPs and 504s? Dr. Harder, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can get us started off here. In general, what we recommend is that families, a parent, will go to the school and request a meeting. So to bring together the group of people that make decisions about these plans, once again, I say put that in writing, at least in our state and I think in many other places, that will start a clock. So they have so many days to respond to your request for a meeting. And from there, the conversations are had. Maybe there's new documentation from the team that either says, we need these new services or accommodations, or we can back down and maybe these aren't needed. And just to have a kind of collaborative discussion. So I think that's the general process for making those changes. And keeping in mind, I think we've mentioned this already, that at the conclusion of a meeting like that, parents do not have to sign in agreement. So if there's still something that's not quite right or that you disagree with, just remember that you have the right not to sign and to kind of continue these conversations until everyone reaches a place that they can agree on. In terms of detail, in my experience, the IEP is very detailed, and it is important that we get all of these plans and accommodations in writing because it holds the school accountable for following through with those. And Dr. Forber-Pratt may want to add from her experience.
Yeah, so kind of a couple things. So first of all, when you're considering an IEP must be reviewed at least once a year, and then students are also reevaluated every 3 years to determine whether services are still needed. And so that's dictated by the federal law. And so I want to make sure that's clear. And in terms of for a 504, generally a 504 plan is also reviewed each year, and a reevaluation is done every 3 years or when needed. But the specific rules with the time frame for a 504, those rules will vary state to state. But then everything that Dr. Harder said in terms of if you feel that it needs to be reviewed or revised outside of that time frame or sooner than that time frame, then yes, absolutely, it is well within your right to request that type of a meeting. But it also is good, smart for you to be aware when that 3-year reeval is occurring for your child, because that is generally a longer type of a meeting and process that is involved. And to echo some of the other comments too about the meeting itself, it's important for you as parents to also be aware that you are able to bring people, you know, on your side, so to speak, to meetings. So whether that's an advocate, whether that's a consultant, you know, I know Dr. Harder mentioned on her intro that she also, you know, will oftentimes attend meetings and so forth with families. I do as well. I would also advocate that to bring your child too, especially if they're in middle school or high school, because this is a chance for them to start to learn about this process and to become an advocate for him or himself or herself. And again, you don't have to sign that document at the end just because the meeting is drawing to a close. And I would encourage you all not to sign if you're not totally happy with it. And so if you need a little bit more time to think things through, that is well within your right. And in terms of detail, yes, I would say that the more detail, the better. And like Dr. Harder said, it truly is a protection for you. However, I would also add this caveat to that no, that does not mean that you need to grant the school district all of your child's medical records. You know, it means that you provide the documentation around the specific disability diagnoses and justification for the types of accommodations that are being discussed and so forth. But that certainly does not mean that you have to provide everything. So I just wanted to make that point too.
To kind of well, we've been talking about how to get support services, but there was a question I thought was interesting. How do you recommend handling teachers or case managers that are insisting that your child should receive these services that you don't think that your child needs? Dr. Harder?
Sure, I'm happy to start this one off. So kind of as we've been saying all along, you know, as the parents, you have the right to, you know, agree or disagree with the accommodations and things that the school is putting forth. And, you know, it's also worth repeating that you can bring people into these meetings with you, as Dr. Forber-Pratt said, that have, you know, people from the medical team or who have evaluated your child directly come and make a case in one direction or another, particularly if you feel strongly about this. And I think Dr. Forber-Pratt may be able to speak to this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think with that too, it's part of it is figuring out what works best for your child. And one of the interesting nuances with the types of disabilities that we're, you know, largely talking about within our membership, as we know that there may be good days and there may be bad days. And I think that it's important to make sure that you're trying to think through what types of accommodations, what is the, on a particular bad day, what is the most level of accommodation and need that I or my child is going to have. And because you're going to want to have that written in, you know, and outlined what those services and supports may look like. However, I think that we also want to, you know, to that question, make sure that we're encouraging as much independence as possible and autonomy in terms of the parts of the student. And so it does become a little bit of a give and take. However, I would advocate that, yes, you know, we want to make sure that whatever that need may be is also in the plan. However, I think that it can also be a conversation around identifying when on a good day, for example, okay, then this type of support may not be needed every single day, for example. And so I think that you need to have that conversation. And again, it's going to vary person to person. From my own experience, I remember going through something similar where my school district wanted me to have a one-on-one aide. And I was not the not a strong believer that that was the best type of accommodation for me. And we had to kind of reach a middle ground with that. And so we had to reach a middle ground with, okay, so if I'm not going to have an aide all the time, then how would I contact an aide for the times that I might need an aide, you know, and so forth. And so we had to kind of go through that give and take and to kind of find that happy in between.
We've been talking a lot about specifically physical needs support in the school or educational support. Are there any support services that apply to extracurricular activities in the educational setting, so like sports or any other kind of extracurricular activity that kind of fall under these 504 IEP plans, or is that a different thing altogether?
No, so something that's been pretty exciting is actually in January of 2013, the federal government, the U.S. Department of Ed, issued a guidance letter that really provided some clarification that all of these types of accommodations and so forth does apply both to extracurriculars and after school sports and so forth. And so that was a really important clarification letter that came down. Schools are just now kind of making that, some schools are just now realizing what that means and so forth. So it is important to advocate for your child across all the domains, not just the academic domains, but also extracurriculars and sport teams and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Harder, kind of shifting gears a little bit to talk about more of the cognitive or psychosocial issues that might be occurring. If there's, for example, a child in school who's having real issues with cognition or even depression in the context of their of one of these diagnoses like NMO or TM, mm-hmm. who are getting a lot of different kinds of meds that could be affecting their mood and things of that nature. Are these kinds of things that should be addressed within IEPs or that the school should be informed about in a formal way? And kind of what is that line, that threshold between that privacy about psychosocial issues with the child versus needs and accommodations in the school setting?
Yeah, great. It's a great topic. So we know that our kids with these rare conditions can experience cognitive difficulties. We've done a lot of work on that here at UT Southwestern in children, so we know that there can be difficulties associated with attention, memory, and not for all of our kids with these conditions, but in some cases, and we know that school problems can, be the result. So I would say, the first thing or first question to ask is, are these things, whatever they are, if it's cognitive difficulties, mood-related symptoms, is it, pain or fatigue? I mean, these are also very common in our kids. Are any of these things reaching a place where they're interfering with daily functioning? And so that can be, all kinds of things, but for school purposes, classroom participation, the ability to sit and focus for long periods of time, to remember information on exams. I mean, it's sort of kind of teasing apart how all these things or these symptoms can affect that classroom performance. And once we kind of know that we're reaching that threshold, I think it is worth considering to start to talk to the school about some of these things, and hopefully by this point, you've enlisted the assistance of someone from the medical team, possibly from a psychologist or neuropsychologist, who can really evaluate these things very carefully and generate some documentation and recommendations to address these things specifically. And I can just kind of put out some ideas that we routinely we'll discuss with our patients and families and that have made a difference for them in a classroom setting. So certainly, there are things like we would call it priority registration in a college setting, but this could definitely apply in high school or other grades, that you get to set the day, schedule the day in a way that works best for the student. So if we know that fatigue really sets in the afternoon, or pain is worse at a certain time of day, we would really recommend stacking the most rigorous courses, say, early in the day, and then having things that maybe require less intensity or concentration, you know, later in the day. If we can schedule in short breaks throughout the day, if there is a protocol that we can go to the nurse, you know, for medication or other things if needed, that there could just be sort of a release valve if a symptom is starting to show up and interfere. And like Dr. Forber-Pratt mentioned, you know, there are, you know, some of these symptoms and some of these things can really get in the way, and it's very much case by case, and we need to figure out, you know, for each person, the functional impact can be quite different, and so we need to be able to sort of describe that and figure out the most appropriate accommodation. So I definitely think, you know, while some of these things, certainly something like depression or cognitive difficulties could be things that, you know, maybe doesn't seem like they're reaching that threshold or that you want to share all of that information, it's definitely a personal decision to do that. But if it is interfering, my recommendation would be to talk with the school, work with the school on that, and figure out ways to address these things head on and provide some relief throughout the day or extra support to help that student be successful.
We're getting to the last 10 minutes of the podcast here, so I'm going to go through another question, maybe two. There's a question here about that their child was diagnosed some years ago and didn't really need a 504 or IEP plan at the time of diagnosis, but now they're having issues with pain and fatigue and things of that nature, like you were just discussing, Dr. Harder. And they haven't had the IEP, like I said, but it's becoming an issue. Is it too late to institute some kind of special plan for the kid if it's years after the diagnosis, even if they've had a noticeable disability but haven't needed one until now? Is there would there be any obstacles to implementing one further into the diagnosis?
So I'll just jump right in on that one and say, no, it's never too late. I mean, there's not a, you know, a set window of time and so forth where, from receival of diagnosis, that you must implement either of these plans. So if you feel that there is a need, then it's not too late to start to explore what that might look like.
And I would just add to that, I agree completely, and I think, you know, as our kids move up in school, the challenges become greater, and so it could be that, you know, whatever the symptom is could be manageable, you know, in the first grade, but by third grade, you know, it's more difficult, or by middle school, things get more difficult. So we actually see this quite often, that our students do just fine there for a while, but then as demands increase, we need to get in there and provide a little bit more support. We also know there can be an evolution with a given condition, and particularly for our chronic conditions, things can change over time. And so we have to be able to acknowledge that and know that, you know, we have to be flexible and reevaluate and constantly be monitoring to make sure that we're providing the support that's needed. And I would say, you know, in most cases that I've worked with, we expect those things to change across time.
Yeah, and just to add to that, as I alluded to in the beginning, my case is very much like that. You know, the types of accommodations that I needed when I was in elementary school, where I was in only one classroom, so to speak, were much different versus starting middle school and you start moving class to class, and then high school, even just the physical size of the building grew, as did the weight of the textbooks. And so for me in high school, that was when I started exploring, hey, can I get a second set of textbooks to be kept at home, because the weight of the textbooks was causing me to actually flip over in my wheelchair, but by me trying to carry them back and forth. And so So I think that's an excellent point, that the demands and the needs and support needs will change over time.
And then one other question I thought was kind of interesting. We're all, I think, pretty aware of the districting rules with you live in this district, therefore you have to go to this school. Say you're in a situation where the school that's in your district is doesn't have great accessibility, and you would need to make a lot of changes, et cetera, but the school, you know, down the street that you're not districted in has better accommodations. Is there a way that, or are there avenues to where you can request to go to a school outside of your district without moving? Or are there ways for the school that you're districted to say, we would prefer for you to go to this other school that's more built for your needs? Is that even a thing that exists?
Yes, it is, and it goes both ways, just like the question alluded to. So for me personally, when I went to start kindergarten, the kindergarten school building that was in my district and kind of the home school that based on zoning rules and so forth, that was where I was supposed to go and where my siblings all went, was not accessible. And so it was considered a reasonable accommodation for the school to send me to another elementary school that was still within my town and so forth. But because that was the school's decision and so forth, and that school could meet my needs, they also had to provide the transportation for me to get to that school. The flip side of that also is that it's going to vary state to state, and it's going to vary district by district. So another example was once I started high school, and day one of high school, it became very clear that high school could not meet my needs. I had started researching other schools outside of my district that were more accessible and that could meet my needs, and I presented the school board and the director of special education and so forth with my list of, hey, I would like to switch schools to one of these schools. What do you think? And that was a slightly more complicated process because, yes, my district did participate in the ability to participate in what they called school choice and so forth, but the caveat was that then the transportation arrangements would have fallen to my parents. And so while we were trying to advocate that because my home school could not meet my needs and I could not get an education with reasonable accommodations in my district, that we wanted them to provide transportation and so forth. So it was met with a lot more resistance, and ultimately that request was denied in my case. And again, this is going to vary person by person and district by district, school by school.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting to the last few minutes of the podcast, and with the last question, I think kind of nicely goes into both you, Dr. Harder, and Dr. Anjali, Dr. Forber-Pratt, kind of giving your takeaway points from this conversation. This is obviously a very multifaceted issue with support services and education, and it's different everywhere you go. It's the same but different everywhere you go. So how can parents know and find out what their rights are specifically in their situation when they're going to ask for accommodations for their child? How do they go about finding out that information just at the beginning? And also, if you could start with your takeaway points for this talk today. Dr. Harder, would you like to begin?
Sure. So I want to say that for these rare conditions, we are just really at the beginning of describing what the needs may be in an educational setting. And I, as we've noted, this is going to differ person by person, but I know that on our side, on the research side, we've started to work on getting this information out through our publications about cognitive functioning, in given conditions. And that work will continue, and I think it will be very important for helping us make the case that our students do need certain supports in educational settings. And So there's that. And I just think that the most important thing for us as clinicians working with patients, for parents, for individuals with these conditions, that to really understand, you know, how this condition, how this disability affects daily life, and if that's academic or otherwise, and really just using that to guide and to drive the things that the services that we need to access. So, you know, I just say enlist the support of your medical teams for that, communicate with the school, hopefully develop that collaborative relationship. And if you have to, you know, take it to the next level if things are not happening, you hope you don't get to that point. But realize that in every state there is an agency that is designated to, you know, apply this federal law to our schools, and so knowing who that is, and in Texas it's the TEA, the Texas Education Agency, but again this will differ by state, and also the Office for Civil Rights will have local offices throughout the country, and that's another resource. So if you're not sure about something and you're not getting anywhere with the school, I think those have been two great resources that our families have been able to use. But I think, you know, the advocacy is very important, and spending the time to help individuals understand what these conditions are about and how they can affect our students and our kids in the classroom. And then just finally, at mylightus.org, there's some great information available. I'm sure that our audience members are all well aware of that. Those resources are a great great place to start when it comes to educating schools and teachers and others about these conditions. And again, thank you for having me today.
And just to, you know, my main key takeaways would be to be an advocate, involve your child in the process as well, and start early. I think that another piece to in terms of where to turn to for resources, one resource too is certainly talking to people who have been there, who have been through this process before. So other parents of children with similar diagnoses and so forth, that can help as you're thinking through the types of things to be advocating for. And like Dr. Harder mentioned, every state board of education kind of oversees these types of regulations, and so every state has that their own agency. I know that that can be a little bit cumbersome and hard to know who do I go and talk to specifically within that agency about disability-related issues. So I would also add that every state also has what are called Centers for Independent Living, and a lot of times they are a clearinghouse for the types of organizations and who to talk to about disability-specific needs when it comes to this. And that was a great starting point, which then they were able to help to connect me to particularly disability education advocates as I was going through the struggles with my own school. So those are some other great resources. And thank you again for involving me in this conversation.
Definitely. Thank you both, Dr. Harder and Dr. Forber-Pratt, for your time today and your expertise in this, like I said before, this complicated process, but very important process for our kids and young adults as they get the education that they need to succeed. Thank you to the community for all of your great questions. They were awesome questions, very astute questions, and I hope we were able to answer a lot of them that were sent in. Thanks to the TMA again, and to Chagai Pharmaceuticals and Alexion Pharmaceuticals for their support of this podcast series. We look forward to the next podcast and the questions that come in. So thanks again, and everybody have a great week.